Queen Esther asking the people to pray to fast. But outside of that, it's relatively a godless book. In addition, there are a lot of questions about Esther herself. I think in the tamed down version, you know, we imagine Mordecai is a spiritual giant, and Queen and Esther is a spiritual giant also, and there's all these things happening. But it's, when you look historically, it's not quite the case. This book is very, very hard to interpret, and basically, I think, in general, historically, the church has taken a very strange approach to this book. For instance, with this particular passage, what's been very popular in terms of interpretation and understanding through the years is pastors have preached for years and years on this passage, basically using King Xerxes saying, see, these are the perils of alcohol. You know, these are the bad things that happen when you drink too much. And they take Queen Vashti and they say, this is a picture of a rebellious woman. And that's really not what's going on. The point of the author is not to tell us those things. The author is writing something to help us to see God, especially when we cannot see God. That's essentially what we're dealing with Esther, is we're dealing in Esther with a situation where literally God doesn't seem to be there. This isn't Israel. This isn't the kingdom, the nation of Israel. This is a foreign nation, foreign king, foreign people, foreign gods. God is not there, but God is there. And for this particular chapter, especially the part that we're looking at today, it drips with irony. You know, absolutely drips with irony. For instance, just to give you a sense of some of the strange things that are going on, there's a private domestic dispute, right? You have the king and his wife, and the king calls for her, and she refuses to come out. The king doesn't want it to be a big deal, and yet what does he do? He passes a law. You know, small domestic abuse turned into a big national uproar. The king, in his discussions with his officials, says, we don't want people to find out about this. And so what do? They announce it to everyone. You know, so there's a lot of weird things going on in here. And essentially, the author is trying to show us that this passage ultimately is about irony. And we'll see what that looks like. You know, the question that we've been asking through the book of Esther and that we're going to keep asking is, what do you do when it seems like God isn't around, when it seems like God isn't there? And for a lot of us, that seems to be most of our lives. You know, we feel like God checks in once in a while, but for the most part, you know, we live out in the world and God really isn't around. Most of us don't work in a church. Most of us work in secular workplaces, and so we don't feel like God's there. We go home, and unfortunately, most of us don't spend all of our time in the scriptures outside of work, so, you know, we feel like most of our lives, most of our friendships, most of our relationships, most of our activities, we do without God being there. And again, I think that's an important question to ask is how do we live? What do we do? How do we act faithfully when it seems like God isn't around? Last week, we talked about what happens when God isn't around. What happens to a king or a leader? He becomes insecure. He becomes unsure. What happens to a kingdom or a nation when God isn't around? There's moral decay. What happens to your life when God isn't around? You have no purpose. You cling to something else, and that never gives meaning. That never fulfills you. That never changes you. So today, as we look at this passage, we're going to look at three ironies. And I'm not going to tell you what the ironies are right up front. I'm going to tell you as we go along. But essentially, we're going to look at the king, we're going to look at the queen, and we're going to look at God himself, and we're going to see the ironies that the author has in store for us. So first, the king. Let's go to verses 10 through 12. And really, these are the verses that we're going to hone in on for each person. But verse 10, it says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagatha, Zethar, and Carcas, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come out at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this time, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Now again, there's a lot of things that are hard to interpret. The author's point isn't the terrible things that can happen with alcohol. That's really not what he's dealing with. But he does make a point that the king is, as he says in verse 10, merry with wine. I don't know if you've seen that before, but I've seen people merry with wine. And it's, you know, it's sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's disconcerting. I'm trying to figure out if I've seen any of you, and I don't know if I have, but you know, the author makes a point to say this, and it makes sense. We've just found out that the king has actually thrown a 6-month party for all his officials and princes and nobles, and then right after that ends, 6-month huge bash, and right after that, he throws a seven-day party for the entire city. And so it's no surprise that at this point, the king's drunk, and he's been drunk for a long time. And again, the author isn't making a point about alcohol abuse or the need for restraint or the importance of making decisions when you're not merry with wine, but he's doing this. If you notice, in verse 10, he connects this statement that he is merry with wine with the commandment that he makes. In other words, the author's point isn't, again, it isn't about alcohol abuse. It's the fact that the author is almost telling us, the assumption is that the king wouldn't have done this if he was sober. You know, that the reason why he made this decision, the reason why he makes this command is because he's merry with wine. If he wasn't, then he wouldn't. And you know, what the author is pointing out is he's pointing out that the Persian court, the palace, is not a safe place. It's not a safe place. Not a safe place for Vashti. If you imagine, at any moment, the king could ask for anything. If you remember, the king is the most powerful king in the world. Xerxes at this point is probably the most powerful king, most powerful entity in the world. He is considered a god. He has conquered nations. At different times, he has held life and death in his hands. He is surrounded by people who are willing at a moment's notice to give their lives up for him. And he is used to people doing whatever he wants them to do. Now, here's the first irony of this part of the story. The first irony is this. The most powerful man, the most powerful king in the world can't get his wife to come out. Right? I mean, that's the first thing we learn. The most powerful man in the world can't even control his own wife. You know, and it's comical in a lot of ways. Here's a man who controls the kingdom, but not his own household. You know, he can say something and everyone jumps except the person who he's married to. And it's extremely comical, but at the same time, it's not. You know, there's a lot going on here. You know, you have to imagine the surroundings. Again, it's a six month party followed by a seven day party, and basically he's drunk. The princes, the commanders, the soldiers are drunk. The people the commoners are all drunk. And his command is for his wife to come out and put on a show. And it's a very tawdry command. Matter of fact, when we're told that the queen is commanded to come out with her crown, there's some scholars that say that essentially the command is that she comes out only with her crown. And so there's a lot kind of going on here. But the point is clear. The point is clear that here is a man who is the most powerful in the world, and yet he has no power at all. That's a great irony of the story. Matter of fact, when you put God into the picture, this reminds us of how God sees this king and how God sees us. Now, here's the most powerful man in the world, yet compared to God, he has absolutely no power. He does not control anything through this book. He is simply someone who is along for the ride. You know, every decision he makes is wrong. Everything he tries to do is foolish, and he cannot steer things in any way. He has no wisdom. He has no foresight. And even though he can make people do things, he's the one dancing like a fool. I mean, that's what the entire story shows us. This man who thinks he is powerful is absolutely powerless before God. And you know, that's important for us to remember too. None of us are kings, but we are to remember that before God, all of us are powerless. And you know, we don't remember that. For some reason, we want to believe, and we do believe, that we control everything in our lives. And when things go out of control, then we ask God to come in, but that's not the way it looks. From God's perspective, he looks at us, and he laughs at us when he sees that we are trying to control our own lives. We are people who have absolutely no control over everything in our lives. We can't steer things. We can't make things better. And when we do, a lot of times we make things worse. The irony of all ironies is the one who is powerful really has no power at all. And again, I think that's an important thing for us to see and remember. Specifically here with the king. Most powerful king in the world has no power at all. Second irony has to do with the queen. If you look into verse 12, it says, "But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him." Again, Vashti is actually a very interesting character because, again, in historic Christianity, when you look at Jewish scholars, and when you look at early Christian scholars, the lesson from this was very clear. It was Vashti is a wicked woman. Don't be like her. You know, and again, using Ephesians 5, they would make their case and say women are supposed to submit to their wives are supposed to submit to their husbands. At the same time, you know, the same scholars would recognize that, you know, if a husband asks for something that's unjust or ungodly, then a wife has every reason to say no to that. What's interesting about Vashti, though, is people's opinion has changed about her. Again, for Jews and early Christians, they used to view her that way. Lately, feminists have really taken a shine to Vashti because, you know, what does she do? She stands up to the king. She stands up to the man, right? You know, here is a male-dominated world, a male-dominated system, and what does she do? She says no. And so, you know, for feminist scholars, they look at this and they say, well, Vashti is really to be emulated. She is to be exalted. Whereas Esther doesn't do that. Esther's a weak woman. Esther is a woman who comes in because of her beauty. She relies on it, and she never challenges the system. You know, she essentially does certain things, but she doesn't. She never stands up to the fact that it's a male-dominated, authoritarian system. She just kind of sneaks her way through. That's actually very unfair because Vashti was a beautiful woman too, who used her beauty, who relied on her beauty. And the truth is that just like Vashti, Esther risked everything. I think the difference between Vashti and Esther, though, when you look at these base facts, is that what Esther did really did change things. And what she did is still celebrated today. But again, that's not the point of what the author is trying to make. He's not trying to say, be like Vashti or be like Esther or don't be like them, anything like that. We have to start with this point and with this place. First of all, we need to remind ourselves that a queen, when she's called queen, it's not what we think she is. You know, when we think about a queen, we think about a woman who is a wife, who is a partner, who is essentially a co-ruler. You know, that's the way it was in England, for instance. You know, if the king died, the queen would rule. And that made sense because she was a wife, she was a partner, and even when the king was there, she had a certain level of authority. In Persian culture, it wasn't like that. A matter of fact, you would have multiple women who were called queens. For instance, if you want to think about the stratosphere of how the palace was set up, at the bottom you had the harem and you had servants. And they were very unimportant people. They didn't hold very high rank at all. They were just there to do the things that they were to do. For the harem, you had the head of the harem, and she was a little bit more important. You had servants. You had the head of the servants, and that person was a little bit more important. The queen was just a little bit above that. She wasn't in the harem. She wasn't the head of the harem. She was a little bit above that. At the same time, she wasn't a partner. She wasn't a co-ruler. Again, the king typically had a handful of what they would call royal wives, and they would have a handful of concubines. And the wives and the concubines all had one purpose, that was to give the king offspring. And so when we find out when we find out this little thing about Vashti, we have to remember that it's not that she's his partner, it's not that she is his co-ruler. She's a woman that because of her beauty has been brought in and she's given a unique place to essentially provide children. She is probably, you know, from what we're told here and from the way that things worked, she was probably very beautiful. But again, she wasn't a co-ruler. She wasn't a partner. When the king calls for her, again, it's tawdry, it's lewd. He calls her to show herself off, but she's important. Now, I want you to notice something. The king calls to her, and she refuses. And the refusal is absolutely crucial to the rest of this part of the story, and it's crucial to everything that's going to happen. The refusal actually launches all the chain of events that lead to Esther and the saving of Esther's people. The refusal is very, very important. Why would a woman who seems to have everything refuse? Well, again, you could say, well, it's tawdry. She probably had enough pride, enough strength of character to say no to those things. I wouldn't argue with you, but I think something very interesting is going on. In our culture, we have this thing, and I'm assuming that it was like this, but I think in our culture we have this myth of beauty, and basically it works like this. When you see someone who is beautiful, we make certain assumptions. We believe certain things about them, right? We believe that they have everything, that they have it all, and that they have everything put together, right? It's one of those, for some reason, it's one of those assumptions we always make. We see someone who's beautiful, we just assume, we go, yeah, they must have everything. So here you have essentially this woman who is one of the loveliest women in the kingdom, this queen. Why would this woman who has everything risk everything, give up everything? Well, in a very simple way, even though it looks like she has everything, she has nothing. This woman who is, and that's the second irony. The second irony is the loveliest queen in the kingdom is actually unloved. And that's the sense we get in the story. If you read carefully through the story, the author never puts the king and queen together as partners. You know, he always separates them. He never talks about them as husband and wife, never gives them, you know, any sense of close relationship. You know, he's very careful in how he describes them and how he talks to them. And the picture that we get is that they're actually very, very distant. You know, the idea that we get is that, you know, when he calls for her and she refuses, again, the idea is that if you look at what he's doing, he's not treating her as a wife. He's not treating her as someone he loves. He's treating her as an object, isn't he? He's calling for her to come out to show herself off so that everyone sees. You know, she's a trophy wife. And you know, in our culture, people do that. And we know that in those types of marriages, there is no love. Husband doesn't see the wife as a partner, as a friend. The woman is simply a thing. And you know, that's exactly what's going on here. You have a woman that is beautiful, that everyone assumes she must have it all. Matter of fact, it looks even more like that. She's living in the castle. And yet, she's willing to give it up because she has nothing at all. And you know, it's a really sad story when you look at it from her perspective. She's willing to give everything up. And it is a risky decision. Matter of fact, she goes into it knowing that this could mean her death. It doesn't, but it's very risky, and that's something we need to remember for the end. Third irony is when we look at God, and here's the irony. I'll give it to you up front. There is a reason why this chapter is full of irony, and the reason why is because these two ironies help us realize there's a third that if you're not careful, you're not going to see. But here's the third irony. The third irony of the first chapter of Esther is that the God who is nowhere to be found is actually there, and he's been there all along. That's a third irony. You know, you read through, and again, there's no mention of God, and yet there's so many things that happen here that are because of God, or that that we know are completely in God's hands. Let me kind of show you what that looks like. If you notice, the story, when we began in chapter 1, it actually doesn't start with Esther or Esther's family. It doesn't even start with Mordecai. Sorry, I wrote Malachi in my notes, and I know that's not right. So, doesn't start with Malachi. It doesn't start with Mordecai either. But it's very unusual. And just to show you, there are a few books that are kind of like this, but if you go into Genesis, Genesis starts out with God, right? Book of Exodus. Exodus starts out with Israel. Leviticus starts out with Moses. You skip forward a little bit. Joshua starts with Moses, but it really starts with Joshua. And Joshua is the first person we really see. In the book of Ruth, we find out about Naomi's family, and that's kind of an important way to start. In 1 Samuel, the first person we see, the first thing we see is Samuel's family. Most of the books of the Bible, the beginning of those books start with the people who are the most important. The book of Esther starts with this pagan king, this pagan queen, and this really weird refusal. You know, this party that's going on, that at the end of the party, the queen refuses. Why? Because this is the event that is the most crucial, that starts the chain of events that for everything else that will happen. The queen's refusal launches a series of other events that eventually brings along Esther, and that it essentially leads to the salvation of the Jews. And, you know, again, for us, we see that because we read the story. We go through the storyline, and sure enough, there's Queen Esther's refusal at the royal party. She is banished. A search starts. Esther is found. She's brought into the kingdom. She has a friend in Mordecai, a cousin. And through all the machinations, she ends up saving the Jewish people. Right? So we see all of that. We know that it's that way. And the author is making the point that God is in this entire event. That God is instrumental to everything that's happening, and that everything that happens even before Esther shows up, even before Mordecai shows up, is that God is at work. And you know, for a lot of us, we don't think about God like that in our lives, do we? God pops in and pops out, doesn't he? Right? When does he pop in? He pops in when we know we're in trouble. He pops in when things are bad, then we say, God, I really need you here. And for our lives, God isn't there all the time. We invoke him. We want him to be there when trouble comes. But what Esther shows us is that even when it seems like God isn't there, he is. And that's an irony. The irony is we spend so much time thinking God's not there. We spend so much time even getting angry and shaking our fist. God, where are you? And God is saying, I'm right here. I'm right here. You know, there's a couple things that happen that I want you to understand. Sovereignty is one of those funny things that I think is easy to believe in. Yes, God rules over everything. Sovereignty means that God rules everything, that everything is under his sight, that nothing happens outside of his hand. I think it's one of those things that's easy to believe. It's hard to actually live as if. Right? It's easy to say, yeah, God is sovereign. God controls everything. It's another thing when you're in the middle of something hard, you go, God, can you please help me? Right? We don't really believe it sometimes. But there's a couple things I want to point out here that hopefully as you mature in Christ, these are things you begin to take on. But there's two things I want you to notice. One, God is there before the problems ever arise. Right? In Esther, nothing has happened yet. The Jews haven't been, a law hasn't been passed to exterminate the Jews yet. But before that ever happens, God is there. And he is setting the course of events for their salvation even before they're in trouble. See, imagine if you were a Jew at that time. You wouldn't think about God, you wouldn't notice God until the law came out saying all Jews can be killed. What? God, where are you? Where have you been? But in the story, God's been there. He's setting everything up, and he sets things up far before. The other thing is this. I want you to notice here that the way God works, I think a lot of times we think that God only uses, you know, really holy, really, really spiritual people. God is using a pagan king. He's using a pagan queen, and he's using this lewd, tawdry party to bring about his result. God uses all of it. God uses everything that's there. He uses even bad people even non-Christians. He uses everyone, everything, to bring about the best. You know, that's one of those things that for you and I, we think that God only works in certain ways, and he doesn't. Here's a God who is not limited by the fact that this is a pagan king and a pagan queen who don't believe in a God who rules over all things. This is a God who's not limited because this is a terrible party going on that he would not have anything to do with it. This is a God who can take even the worst people, even the worst things, and mold it and bend it to do his very best. And you know, if you don't believe in that, then you're not going to have a God who can help you very often. You're going to have a God who can only work through certain people, certain times, certain things, and that will bring you very little comfort. You have a God who can shape the course of human history and who can deal with every last detail to such a degree that it is exactly the way he wants it to be. And it means that nothing is unimportant to God. It means that everything matters to him. I know some people say, well, I mean, why would God care about this? Or how can God care? There's so many other things going on in the world. God is not limited. He doesn't listen to prayer requests and go, whew, I'm tired. I mean, that's all I can handle today. I mean, people praying all the time, asking for all these things, I just can't handle. War going on here, this person asking for this. I mean, how can I handle it all? Oh, man, that's not how God works. God is infinite. It means that his resources are never exhausted. He is never tired, he doesn't grow weary, and he can handle the weight of the world. He can handle the small things and the big things. And again, that's what you need. And again, we see all of this through the fact that God even uses a pagan queen's refusal to show herself. You know, what's interesting is, in a lot of ways, for this part of the story, the way that we see Christ is through this pagan queen. And it's very, very strange to say, but for the pagan queen, if you notice, she is asked to show herself off. And essentially, this comes at the risk of her own life. And she refuses. She refuses because of love. She refuses because she knows she isn't loved. In this way, she shows us Christ. Jesus also risks his own life. But he does it not because he's not loved. He does it because he is loved. And he does it to love. For Jesus always had it. He was always loved from the beginning of time, and he always loved. And when he is challenged with that same question to give up his life, to risk his own life, he does. Matter of fact, that's our lead into taking communion today. Every time we take communion, it's a reminder that Jesus actually did give up his life. You know, we look at the queen and we think, wow, she must have been a very noble woman. She must have had a strong sense of her own integrity, her own dignity. And we are amazed by that. We're amazed that she would be even willing to risk her own life. Well, Jesus has done even more. If you're amazed by a queen who's willing to risk her own life, you should be enthralled by Jesus who gave his life. And when you realize that that's what he did for you, then you begin to see the gospel irony. That you who deserve wrath and condemnation have now been given life through Jesus Christ. So as we get ready to take communion, I want to ask